Listen, the birds sing. Listen, the bells ring. All the living are dead, and the dead are all living. The war is over, and we are beginning.
Chapter 12. Beck dies on a Tuesday. It should not be a surprise. Steve's had a year to prepare for this moment. Before he even got out of the car in Brooklyn that first time, Rachel warned him that this was coming. "Rebecca's sick," she said, and Steve's had months and months of hearing Beck cough and wheeze to know that it's true. Beck's been so sick. She ended up in the hospital when Steve was off on another continent, with blood splattered on his face. And that bout of bronchitis got better, but Beck stayed weak. She ate less, slept less. Somehow, despite her labored breathing and lack of appetite, she finished her book, and then had another good month before she got sick again. Pneumonia, this time. And still, somehow, Steve is surprised when she finally goes. She let them take her to the hospital at first, but refused to stay after it became clear she wasn't getting better. She said, "I always wanted to die in my own home." So they brought her back to the apartment, set up a hospital bed in the living room, and waited. Steve has days, sitting around in the living room with Rachel as Beck's body shuts down, to get used to the idea of Beck dying, but he doesn't. She stays so sharp, so lucid and aware, right until the very end. She tells Steve she loves him, and then whispers something in Rachel's ear that has her choking out a sob and whispering back. "I'm gonna shut my eyes now," Beck says, her voice so painfully thin. She sleeps, and they watch her chest move, her lungs struggling for each breath. Mia's there, quietly checking Beck's vitals, and nodding at them as she wipes away tears. Any time, now. Still, it takes hours, well into the night, when Steve watches Beck's chest stop moving, hears her take her last, wheezing breath. "Are you sure?" Rachel keeps saying, staring intently at her wife, still holding her hand. Her chest moved. "Steve, don't you see her breathing? Are you sure? I swear I just saw her chest move." Mia is sure. She murmurs a time of death, and quietly excuses herself to make whatever call she's got to make. Steve's sure, too, but he's surprised into silence, dumbfounded and utterly baffled by the notion of Beck being gone. He's seen death, he knows death, but in his experience it's usually quicker, louder, bloodier, accompanied by wailing mortars and desperate screams. Beck's peaceful slide into death doesn't make sense to him, and he keeps staring at Beck's still chest, trying to believe it. In the last year, Beck's been such a constant, one of his touchstones to his old life before the war, and Steve couldn't do anything for her. He just sat close, listened to her babble some drug-induced pleasantries, and watched her die. So painfully useless, just like when he let her brother fall. "Steve," Rachel whispers as she finally lets go of Beck's hand. "Cover her, please. I can't. Oh, God." She starts murmuring a prayer in Hebrew, and Steve does as she says, getting one last look at Beck's face before pulling up the sheet. After the funeral, they go back to the apartment, and Rachel does not leave for 7 days. She recites the same prayer 3 times a day, and accepts a small, steady stream of mourners. Steve's heard stories about most of these people, but it's so odd to be meeting them now that Beck's gone. There's Mel, the man who took over running Rachel's clothing company when she retired 25 years ago, and a handful of Frank's children and grandchildren. There's people who spent years of their youth in the home, and people who took Beck's classes back when she was still teaching. A whole horde of Buchanans even show up, descendants of Bucky's many uncles. But they give Steve space when it becomes clear that their presence overwhelms him. Tony brings Beck's favourite kind of whiskey, and gets weepy when he leads a toast. Natasha brings pie. Clint brings his dog, and Rachel's not been saying much to anyone, but she spends a solid hour with her hands in Lucky's fur. No one stays long, and Steve can always breathe a little easier when the apartment empties out again. When it's just the two of them, Rachel manages to talk a little more. They eat an excessive amount of matzo ball soup. On day 8, Rachel explains that they've got through Shiva, even though Steve somehow missed that they were doing that at all. They sit together on the couch, and Rachel says, "It was more for me than for Beck. She wasn't all that Jewish, but she wasn't all that Catholic either, and she indulged me plenty. She'd have indulged this, too." "Yeah," Steve says, wrapping an arm around her shoulders as she sniffles into a handkerchief. She turns to look up at him, her big brown eyes red-rimmed and wet. "What do we do now?" she asks. "I've got no earthly idea," Steve replies. So they sit on the couch, for lack of anything better to do. Rachel bawls and soaks the front of his t-shirt. Steve holds her, feeling more useless than he did in 1941, when everything just kept going from bad to worse to catastrophic. Beck's gone, and Steve's got no earthly idea what to do next. S.H.I.E.L.D. waits a respectful 2 months after Beck dies, a whole 2 weeks after the anniversary of the Chitauri, to ask again. Steve says yes before Agent Hill even gets her whole request out, and they blink at each other for a moment, both equally surprised by his quick answer. "You are aware this would require a move to D.C., she says, like she's trying to talk him out of it. "I know. And it would be full-time. You'll have some say in the selection of your missions, and you'd lead the strike team. But for the most part, orders are going to come right from Director Fury." "I know." Agent Hill frowns up at him before finally nodding. "Okay, great. When can you start?" Steve bites his cheek to keep from saying, "Tomorrow, please give me something useful to do. Give me someone I can actually save." He talked to Rachel about the possibility of joining S.H.I.E.L.D. for real, told her after Agent Hill first approached him with the job offer. But that was all back when Beck was still alive. "You want to take it," she said then, after studying his face for an inordinately long time. When he told her he didn't know, he meant it. But Beck's gone now, and Steve's back to being desperate for distraction, for purpose, for people he can actually help. "I'm gonna need at least a couple weeks," he tells Hill. "Why don't you take until the end of the month? We'll expect to see you in D.C. on the 1st. Steve doesn't have much stuff, but Rachel seems determined to see him off with at least a couple boxes full of personal items. She insists that he pack up all the clothes he's accumulated in the last year, and then gives him a pie tin and some extra silverware. He lets her fuss, lets her pack, until she tries to take his mother's landscapes off the walls. "No." Steve wraps his fingers around Rachel's tiny hands as she reaches up towards the paintings. "But they're your mother's," she says, pouting up at him. "They're yours." "Rachel, they're giving me a bland, modern box to live in. It's just going to be somewhere to sleep between missions. My ma's paintings belong here, okay? Besides, what am I going to look at when I come home for a visit if you take them down?" Rachel laughs, a few tears gathering at the corners of her eyes. "You better come home, every chance you get."
"I will."
"I mean it, Stephen. Even if it's just today, you'll get on that train or take your motorcycle. You'll brave the 4-hour trip or you take a helicopter or something. You come home." Steve gets a little teary-eyed himself. "I will. Hey, that's enough packing for now. Let's go sit on the balcony." Mia has iced tea in the refrigerator. So they settle on the balcony with glasses of iced tea and fresh lemon slices. Rachel closes her eyes and tilts her face towards the sun. "We were together for 68 years, you know," she says.
1945, huh?
"Eventful year, that 1945. Rachel smiles. "It was right after you died, right before Germany surrendered. And I swear, right up until it happened, I thought she hated me, even though she'd stuck with me like glue since you left for the front."
"She did?"
"Dragged me along to all the Barnes family events, made sure I wasn't alone." Rachel shakes her head and laughs. I was so blind. Hey, you figured it out eventually. Beck figured it out first. She always was the brains of the unit. Rachel laughs again. When she wipes the tears from her eyes, Steve doesn't mention it. She drinks her tea and closes her eyes, tilting her face towards the sun. I wish her book didn't end with Buck and I dying, Steve says. I never did get the whole story of how you two ended up together, and I'd like the full autobiographic version of your lives, you know, written in Beck's own words. Oh, she wrote that years ago. What? Steve sits up a little taller and stares at Rachel, but she's in no hurry to open her eyes. End of the line, that's the abridged version. It started off as a memoir, Beck's life story, but the whole thing ended up being the size of about 4 books put together. It's part Barnes family history and part social commentary too, but she decided to narrow her focus to you and Bark. The original manuscript is somewhere around here. You can read it if you want. Huh, says Steve, and then he goes back to drinking his iced tea. The sun sets and Rachel starts to shiver, so they go inside. She sits at the kitchen table while Steve gets a casserole Mia made into the oven for dinner. This time next week, Steve will be in DC and Rachel will be on her own for dinner. Rachel's made it very clear, from pretty much the moment Beck died, that she didn't want Steve hanging around, turning into Rachel's caregiver and putting his own life on hold. But Steve still feels so guilty. Even if he'll be doing good, keeping people safe, keeping people free, Rachel will be on her own. Have you thought about coming with me? He asks. Rachel pauses with a fork halfway to her mouth. She raises an eyebrow at him. You said you liked the place where Peggy lives, right? Well, you could live there, with Peggy. I'm going to visit Peggy all the time, and that way you'd be there, too. He says it all in a rush, his words getting progressively more desperate as he continues, and by the end he's blushing. Bubbleh. She sets down her fork and reaches out to cover his hand with hers on the table. I'm staying here. Okay. He sounds very small. They say you're not supposed to make any big decisions for a year after you lose your spouse, so I'm staying here. Steve laughs a little. Who is this they? Well, Beck told me. There's been studies on it, apparently. She made me promise to not do anything rash. Rebecca really did all she could to prepare them both for her death. Steve wonders if Rachel wakes up every morning, surprised that Beck's gone like Steve is. Ask me again in a year, Rachel says. She pats his hand twice and goes back to eating. This is not 1942, Steve. You aren't leaving me all on my own. I've spent decades building a life here, and Beck might be gone, but I'm not alone. I've got Mia and the home and a bunch of grown-up kids who used to live here. I've even got friends, although I admit I haven't seen much of them, with Beck needing to be home so much these last few years. You don't need to feel guilty for leaving, if leaving's what you need to do. It is, Steve admits, although he still can't fully explain why to himself. He's almost desperate to get to DC, to throw himself back into the military and a life he got used to during the war. You're not marching into Nazi territory, Rachel reminds him. You're going to DC. You'll come home to visit, and if you think I won't be calling you every single day to talk your ear off, well, I've got news for you, Bubbleh. Steve lets out a big breath, relaxing back into his chair. I love you, Rachel. I love you too, Steve. Eat your supper. And somehow, even though his Mars landscapes stay on Rachel's hallway walls, when Steve moves to DC, he unearths a photograph that used to sit on the mantel of him, Rachel, and Bucky hanging out at a bar a long, long time ago. On his first day as a commander of his own strike unit of SHIELD agents, the intercom in his apartment buzzes just as he's pulling on his jacket and patting down his pockets for the keys to his bike. Hello? He answers. Yes, this is Senior Assist, a ride service for the elderly. Natasha's voice crackles over the speaker. I'm here to pick up Old Man Rogers. He rolls his eyes. Funny. Clint thinks so. Clint has a terrible sense of humour. Hey! Clint yells in the background, and Natasha laughs before the speaker goes quiet. He takes the stairs, jumping whole landings and making it to the ground floor in a matter of seconds. Natasha is leaning against a sleek black sports car parked on the curb. Clint's in the back seat, hanging his head out the window like he's lucky. Steve pauses for a minute on the sidewalk, just to look at them. Last night, he went to sleep convinced that this was a bad call, that he should just give up on serving his country and go back home to Rachel. But looking at Natasha and Clint is reassuring. This is where he's supposed to be. He's almost certain. Good morning, Captain. Natasha opens the door for him with a flourish, bowing as he gets in the car and making him laugh. We got your coffee, boss, Clint says, pointing towards the cup holder. I didn't know you'd be joining the team, Barton, Steve replies as Natasha slides into the driver's seat. He shrugs. I'm mostly here for moral support. I'll only be around sometimes. Steve nods and sips his coffee while Natasha pulls out into traffic. The drive to the Triskelion is quiet. It takes longer than the subway would and is less soothing than his bike, but he appreciates the company. His palms are sweaty, his stomach in knots, and logically he knows that he'll be fine. He's got plenty of experience leading elite units, but he's nervous anyway. Like it's the first day of art school or the first morning at Camp Lehigh. In his pocket, his phone buzzes, and he grins when he sees a message from Rachel. Have a good first day, Bubbler. You'll be great. Now that he lives in DC, he's especially thankful that the kids at the home taught Rachel's text message. The Triskelion is as modern and intimidating as it's always been, shiny and metallic, with massive windows and grey floors. Inside, it's buzzing with activity, everyone walking straight and tall, looking like they're military. Everyone has purpose. Everyone is useful. Hey, says Natasha, holding the elevator open for him. You ready for this? Steve closes his eyes and clenches his jaw. He takes a deep breath and remembers what it's like to be Captain America. When he opens his eyes, he nods at Natasha and stands up a little straighter. I'm ready, he says, and for the first time in a long time, he actually believes it. After Bucky leaves for basic, Steve can't stand the stillness of their apartment. Three times, he packs up all his art supplies, determined to head for Sully's for the day. And three times, he's halfway down the block when he remembers that Sully's and its proprietor are gone, the both of them locked up tight. The fourth time it happens, Steve fights the urge to go home and just stay in bed all day, ready to cower in the face of sheer frustration and missing Bucky. Instead, he gets on a trolley for Williamsburg. It's not far to ride, but Steve deeply resents that it requires public transportation to go see Rachel. He wants her back behind the bar, within walking distance, and back home where she's free with her smile and quick to laugh. Really? He should just move her into his and Bucky's place. It's not like Bucky is using his bed. The morning Bucky left basic, they rearranged the furniture in the bedroom, pushing their beds to opposite walls with the dresser in between them. Bucky said, Steve, in that soft, terrible, heartbreaking way, when he caught Steve staring at the pushed-apart beds, and Steve shrugged off Bucky's warm hand on his shoulder and left the room to keep himself from crying. But after they train him up, Bucky's hopeful that they'll send him home, at least for a minute. They'll need the beds then, for however long Bucky's allowed to stay. Maybe after he gets shipped overseas, and Steve bites his cheek bloody to keep from crying on the trolley at the thought of Bucky overseas. He'll invite Rachel to be his roommate. Except the old bitties on the first floor would definitely have something to say about Steve moving in his sweetheart without marrying her first. Then the whole neighborhood will get to talking nasty about Rachel and her lack of virtue. Maybe they should just get married, like Rachel always said they should. They'll get married, and maybe Bucky will finally stop telling Steve to go out with girls. Try and find a wife while I'm gone, okay? Bucky kept saying in the days before he got on the train. Just remember that you have options. Steve should definitely just marry Rachel. That'll shut Bucky up once and for all. Although it's been weeks since he left, Steve still hasn't got a letter. Not a single one. He'd read pages full of Bucky badgering him about taking out girls, just to hold a little proof between his hands that Bucky's still out there somewhere. He's so deep in his head that he nearly misses his trolley stop, and has to scramble to make it out the doors, smacking his portfolio into innocent passengers as he goes. The bell above the door rings out when Steve opens it, stepping into Frank's shop. Rachel's leaning against the front desk, smoking a cigarette. She's talking to a customer, a pretty blonde who's halfway through pulling on her jacket and gloves. Rachel has a smile for him like she always does, but it's small and sad. It's been small and sad since they lost Sully. It was totally non-existent for a while, after Zelda left. "Hi," Steve says, rubbing his hands together as he tries to warm up. "Mind if I work here today?" "Have a seat." Rachel gestures towards the front desk with her cigarette, and then seems to remember that Steve's lungs don't do so well around smoke. She rushes to put it out in a nearby ashtray. "Bonnie, this is my friend, Steve. Steve, meet Bonnie Lewis." "Ma'am?" Steve nods and takes off his coat. "It's a pleasure to meet you," she says, polite as anything. But she barely glances at him, too busy pulling on her own gloves, as she gets ready to step out into the frozen hell that is Brooklyn in February. "So I'll be in at the end of the week for a final fitting. That'll be with you, right?" "Should be," Rachel replies, scribbling a note in the date book. "I'd really rather you to Mr. Morelli." "All right, it'll be me. Have a good week, Bonnie." Bonnie beams at Rachel as she leaves, the bell dinging above the door. Steve dumps his coat on a chair, wishing more than anything for Rachel to grin at him and say, "So, do you think she's queer?" But Rachel's gone from seeing lesbians on every corner to complete silence on the subject. Rachel's developed that shame in being queer rather late in life, and it might be Steve's least favourite consequence of everything that happened last year, besides Bucky going to basic. "How are things?" Rachel asks, as Steve gets settled at the front desk. He's showed up here enough times in the last month that Rachel no longer feels obligated to lecture him on the rules. If a customer shows up, he's got to be nice and professional before immediately going to get Rachel or Frank from the back. He's absolutely not allowed to try to talk to any customers about tailoring or prices or anything. "Fine," Steve replies, sighing. Rachel gives him a look, and Steve can admit that the sigh was a bit dramatic, but it's freezing out there, and Bucky hasn't written him a letter, and yesterday he used a different name to try enlisting in a recruitment centre in the Bronx. 4F again, unfit for service. "I thought I'd have a letter from Bucky by now, is all," Steve confesses. "Oh!" Rachel leaps into action. She starts rifling through the top drawer of the desk, and Steve's got no idea what's going on, but it's a relief to see a little bit of Rachel's spark. She's even smiling, big and wide and enthusiastic. "Ah!" She gives a celebratory little shout when she emerges with a letter. "What?" "This came with the mail for the shop yesterday. Sorry I opened it, but it is addressed to me, after all, so you'll have to forgive me." Steve frowns, taking the letter. He studies Rachel's name on the front, written in Bucky's careful lettering. "He wrote you," Steve demands, scowling with everything he's got at Rachel, even though it's Bucky he's really mad at. Rachel grins a little bigger. "Just read it." Frowning all the while, Steve gets the letter out of the envelope. It's thick, at least 4 pages front and back, all written in Bucky's neat hand. Steve's the artist, but Bucky's the one with the handwriting that might as well be calligraphy. Steve reads about 3 sentences before his ears turn red, his blush burning in his cheeks. "This is a love letter," he whispers. Rachel laughs again. She's so warm and bright, her eyes twinkling, and she looks so much like her old cheerful self that Steve stops being mortified that Rachel read these words. "It's a clever trick, isn't it?" she says, delighted. With the screeners, he can't exactly go writing stuff like that to his best pal Steve. "I wonder if he'll address his letters meant for me to you." Shrugging, Steve goes back to his letter. Filled with all of Bucky's longing is such a goddamn relief, given that they spent Bucky's last days at home bickering. Steve tried to go enlist for the first time on December 13th, sneaking off while Bucky was at the gym with his father and his uncles. Bucky yelled about that for a while, and then yelled even more when Steve told him about his determination to try again, as many times as it took. They fought some more, when Bucky suggested they take a couple of dames out, lecturing Steve about trying to settle down with a girl while Bucky was gone. They managed not to sniff at each other on Bucky's last night home, and Steve got to say everything he wanted to say about loving Bucky and missing Bucky. But this letter is all love and no fight. There's no sections devoted to Steve's future wife, and no lectures on Steve defrauding the federal government when he tries to enlist with false names. Wow, Steve murmurs, breathless. Oh boy. Rachel laughs some more. You better get that dopey look off your face before my next customer gets in. You look ridiculous. This is a love letter. Yeah, a dirty love letter. Rachel. It's great, Steve. You better sign your reply with my name, though. Don't go forgetting. While Rachel's in the back with her next customer, Steve writes his reply. He's not Bucky. The words don't come nearly as easy, but the feeling is there. He neglects his R to write out 4 pages and signs it simply R. By the time Rachel's closing up the shop, Steve's still so happy that he drags her to the automat around the corner and treats her to dinner. Steve shows up for Mass on Sunday, and Bet crashes into him the moment he sets foot in the sanctuary. She demands to know if Steve's heard from her brother, and her whole body sort of sags with relief when Steve says he got a letter. She drags him back to the Barnes' usual pew, and he gets quizzed all over again by Winnie. He really thought Bucky's ma would be annoyed that Steve's heard from her son when she hasn't, but she's just as relieved as Beck. After the service, Winnie leads him back to the car and lets him have the front seat while the kids climb into the back. She doesn't even give him a polite invitation to supper at the house, just assumes that he'll be coming over like usual. Part of Steve thought he wouldn't get invited at all. He was preparing for Winnie to use Bucky's absence as an opportunity to get rid of the sickly little nuisance of her son's best friend once and for all. But nothing's different. All the Barnes treat him just the same as when Bucky's around. Treat him like family. Before dinner, George sets up the chessboard and pours Steve a glass of wine. George seems like he's got no desire to talk, although he listened avidly while Winnie and Beck quizzed Steve over the contents of Bucky's letter once again when they got back to the house. But halfway through the game, Steve blurts out, "I tried to enlist, twice." George raises his eyebrows, purses his lips, and looks painfully like his son. "Twice," he repeats. "I went into the city and used a fake name the second time." "That's fraud, son." Steve shrugs and moves his rook. "I thought maybe you could give me some exercises to go through, so I have half a shot next time. Calisthenics or something." "What? You think enough lunges will help with that asthma?" George asks, blunt as anything. Steve winces, but at least George ain't going on about how it's psychosomatic, all in Steve's head, a result of his weak will. Plus, they both know that asthma is far from Steve's only health issue. "Never mind," Steve mutters, making a stupid move with his knight. George takes it immediately and sips his wine. "You know we're at the gym on Tuesdays," George says as he closes in on Steve's king. "Join us." "Really? Kieran ain't gonna like that." The eldest Buchanan brother made it very clear that Steve just slowed them down, back when they were kids and he'd tag along with Bucky for boxing lessons. And since Bucky moved out of the house, he's been downright hostile, making sure his kids don't get anywhere near the perverts. He's by far the least pleasant of Bucky's uncles. "There is a very long list of things Kieran doesn't like," George says. "And I stopped caring about it a very long time ago." "All right." Steve's not even bothered that he's going to lose this game terribly. "I'll be there." The workouts don't help much. After a couple months spent training, he takes his chances at a place in the Bronx. It's no good. 4F, again. When Bucky comes home at the end of the summer, after a whole heaping pile of additional training that he's not allowed to talk about, Steve drags Rachel along to meet him at Grand Central. They get there too early, a result of Steve's fear of being even a moment late, and Steve bounces on the balls of his feet as they wait, Rachel smirking at him the whole time. Bucky emerges, and Steve gets breathless staring at him, so goddamn handsome in his crisp uniform, his hat on at a jaunty angle. He's looking around frantically, gazing every which way, and Steve will call out for him, just as soon as he finds his voice. "Hey!" Rachel shouts next to him, jumping and waving her arms above her head. "James Buchanan!" Bucky's head whips around, and he's beaming so bright that Steve gets even more breathless. Bucky works his way through the crowd, and immediately pulls Steve into a tight hug. It probably goes on for too long, but Rachel's right there with a hand on his back, the size of the crowd, enough to make them anonymous and safe. "Missed you," Bucky whispers in his ear, before he lets go to hug Rachel. He lifts her off her feet, swinging her in the air, and Rachel laughs. "Let's go home," Bucky says, as he slings one arm over Rachel's shoulders and the other over Steve's. On the train to Brooklyn, Bucky invites Rachel over for dinner because it's the polite thing to do. Rachel smirks, glances at Steve to see him glaring and shaking his head, and then smirks even more. "You could not pay me to come over to your place tonight," Rachel says. "But I'll see you tomorrow for dinner with your folks." When they get back to the apartment, Bucky turns him around and presses him into the wall the moment Steve's thrown the deadbolt. Steve laughs, reaching up to cradle Bucky's face between his hands and pulling him down for their first kiss in months. "And you were trying to invite Rachel over for dinner," Steve scolds. "Will you shut up and kiss me?" So Steve kisses him, laughing into his mouth as Bucky lifts him off his feet, wrapping Steve's legs around his waist and pressing Steve more firmly against the wall. "How you been, for real?" Bucky asks, breathing heavy. "Fine, honey." Steve tosses Bucky's hat in the direction of the couch and runs his fingers through his hair. "I told you, it's been fine." "Sick?" "Not really." "Not really?" "I had a little bug in April. Only had me off my feet for a week and a half." Steve kisses the frown right off Bucky's face before he can say anything more about it. "How long do you got?"
5 days.
5 whole days? Right now, 5 days might as well be an eternity. It's more time than Steve thought they'd have, and it seems like forever, even with all the month they've been apart.
5 days, Bucky grins.
"Then it's on to merry old England."
He uses a heinous English accent, and Steve laughs so hard his whole body shakes, and Bucky nearly drops him.
"You gotta work on that accent, pal. They hear you talking like that, and you're bound to get kicked out of the country straight away."
"You're saying you don't like a fellow with an accent?"
"A Brooklyn accent, maybe."
Bucky grins.
"Are you done yapping? Thought you might want to have your way with me now."
Steve leans forward with all his weight, pushing off the wall. Bucky stumbles a little, but he recovers quickly, and he gets the message, laughing as he carries Steve all the way to the bedroom. As it turns out, 5 days is not an eternity, and all that time gets swallowed up by all the things Bucky insists they do and people he's just gotta see. They let Rachel feed them lunch and Winnie feed them dinner. They watch Peter's band play at one of Bucky's favourite jazz clubs and stay out too late drinking with him after. Raoul even shows up, and they all drunkenly rant about desegregation and the army. They take Beck to the movies and the twins to Coney Island. On the last night before Bucky leaves for the war, he's got some meeting with his unit in the afternoon, and Steve takes the opportunity to 4F again. He's so frustrated he goes looking for trouble in some alley and promptly gets beat up. Bucky comes to his rescue, just like old times. Bucky starts going on about the Stark Expo and a double date, meeting up with the girls. Steve just nods along. He lets Bucky lead him to the train out to Flushing, completely miserable that Bucky will be gone in the morning, and that Steve has once again failed to find a way to follow him, to follow all the other men fit to serve. "Wait." Steve pauses at the stairs leading to the subway platform, frowning over his shoulder at Bucky.
"Girls? We're meeting girls? As in more than one?"
"Yeah," Bucky replies. When he tugs on Steve's jacket sleeve,
Steve follows, because people are starting to glare and grumble, with them blocking the flow of traffic.
"We don't know a whole lot of girls, Bucky," Steve says as they wait for the train.
"Speak for yourself. I dated my way through the entire single female population at Assumption."
Steve rolls his eyes.
"More like failed to date."
Bucky laughs, and then abruptly stops, grimacing down at his shoes.
"Fuck," he whispers. "I'm gonna miss you."
Much to his horror, Steve's about a breath from crying right there on the platform, but then the train comes screeching in. He allows himself to be distracted by the squeaking brakes and rumbling metal, the hum of voices as the doors open and the people get out, the push of the crowd getting on after them. The doors close behind them, and Steve gets jostled closer to Bucky as all the people shift around and find a spot for the ride.
"Bucky," he says, his hand going tight on the handle as the train jostles him.
"Who's the other girl?"
"What?"
Bucky's looking at everything but Steve. In a minute, he'll probably casually start whistling just to further prove his own nonchalance, and Steve watches him with narrowed eyes.
"Well, you said we're going to meet some girls. One's got to be Rachel. Who's Rachel's date?"
"Me."
Steve blinks. The train is crowded and not quiet, and Bucky's speaking pretty far from his good ear. Maybe Steve misheard.
"You?"
"Yes, me."
Bucky leans down, talking close. No way he'll mishear anything now.
"Rachel's date, in the flesh. You're looking at him."
Steve blinks some more, opens his mouth a couple times to reply, doesn't know what to say, and then goes on blinking. It takes him a solid 30 seconds to figure out what's going on here for himself.
"Who's the girl, Buck?"
"Her name's Bonnie."
"Bonnie?"
"Rachel's her tailor. They're friendly. She's a secretary for an officer stationed at the Navy Yard, and she likes social realism."
Steve snorts.
"She likes social realism."
"Well, she knew what it was when Rachel brought it up, at least."
"What in the hell is Rachel doing talking about social realism with her clients, huh? What, are you two conspiring? Is she quizzing girls to see if they'd be a good fit for me? How the hell did you talk her into this?" Before they locked up Sully, Rachel would have been spitting mad if Bucky shared his plans to pawn Steve off on some unsuspecting dame before he shipped off to the war. But now the two of them are conspiring to get Steve dates. It's infuriating, and Steve reminds himself that Rachel's been through a lot, had her foundational beliefs shaken right down to dust when they closed up the bar and took away Sully. He understands why she's suddenly so willing to take part in Bucky's schemes to have Steve dating ladies. But he's still pretty mad about it.
"Just try to get to know her a little," Bucky says.
"I don't want to get to know her a little."
"Please, will you try? For me."
Bucky should absolutely not be looking at him like that on a packed public train. And he absolutely should not be using his ridiculously appealing face to get Steve to agree to get to know some dame.
"Why?" Steve demands. "What's the point?"
Bucky grimaces and looks down at his shoes.
"I don't want you to be alone. If something happens to me and I don't make it home, I just can't stand it, the thought of you alone."
Swallowing back all his own fear, he pushes into Bucky's space, letting the motion of the train knock their bodies together. He gets a hand on Bucky's jaw, forces him to look up a little. Bucky's all wide-eyed. Sometimes he looks so painfully young, especially when his lip trembles like that. Steve wants to be home, where he could climb into Bucky's lap and kiss away some of his terror. This subway car will just have to do. All the people crowded together like sardines and determinedly minding their own business feels like something close to privacy.
"You're gonna be fine, Bucky."
Steve is all steel and conviction. This he believes with every ounce of himself, because he has to, because Bucky doesn't. "You're smart and brave and a crack shot. You're gonna come home."
"But..."
"No, you will, one way or another. And in the meantime, I'm going to be fine too." Now is not a good time to mention that he still has no plans to be left behind, that he'll be trying to enlist under a new fake name the second he's got an opportunity.
"I won't be alone. I've got Rachel. I've got Beck and your family. I've got the Boyds and Peter. Peter's going to be drafted any minute, Bucky mutters, but his eyes ain't so wide anymore. There's no tremble in his lip. Buck, you gotta stop worrying about me and start worrying about you, all right? Didn't I promise to look after myself? Are you gonna make me say that all again? Bucky smiles a little, and Steve drops his hands, shuffles backwards. No, Bucky sighs. I just want someone around who loves you. If you accuse Rachel of not loving me, she'll sock you right in the jaw. Bucky laughs, but does nothing to call off this whole absurd night. They find the girls outside the expo. Rachel winces when she sees him, shrugging a little, before making the introductions. Bonnie's disappointment in him is obvious the moment she gets a good look at him, her whole face falling and her posture going from straight to slumped. We've actually met, Steve says when they're introduced. Oh? She blinks at him. Yeah, at Rachel's shop. I was coming in just as you were headed out. Oh, yes, I remember now, she says, but Steve doesn't believe her. And then she spends the majority of the night flirting with Bucky. Bucky and Rachel spend the majority of the night talking up Steve. Steve spends the majority of the night embarrassed and uncomfortable. And Stark's flying car doesn't even fly. Bucky wants to go dancing, and he should, because this is his last night stateside, and he should do everything he loves, which always includes dancing. Steve spots an enlistment center he hasn't tried yet, the one upside to coming all the way out to Queens to see a car that doesn't even fly, and Bucky catches him staring at it. Just don't get arrested, okay? Bucky sighs, resigned. If Steve times this right, he'll get home when Bucky does, assuming he sticks to his usual 3 drinks and 1.5 hours of dancing. Of course, Steve does not really expect Dr. Erskine and a real chance of following Bucky to war. That puts him behind schedule a bit. Well? Bucky's sitting on the edge of their cobbled-together bed, 2 singles pushed back in the centre of their room since Bucky got back from basic. He's unlacing his boots, but he's got the rest of his uniform on, even the hat. Good. Steve wants to peel the whole thing off him, piece by piece. Oh, you know, says Steve, shrugging. It's almost a lie, but he won't send Bucky overseas upset. He'll tell Bucky later, on the off chance Steve makes it and gets through the whole program. There's really no reason to tell Bucky about Dr. Erskine until he absolutely needs to know. You're getting a whole lot better at getting rejected, I gotta say. Steve scowls. Gee, thanks, Buck. But you've got a lot of practice at this point. Oh, come on. You think you're finally done defrauding the federal government trying to get your ass in the army? I'm making no promises. Bucky makes a big show of sighing and rolling his eyes as he drops his boots on the ground. He's smiling a little, though, fond and indulgent. You want to come give me some of that sweet, sweet sugar? Bucky waggles his eyebrows, looking Steve over from head to toe. His tongue pokes out at the corner of his mouth, and he licks his bottom lip. Despite his blush, Steve crosses his arms over his chest and glares. You sure you wouldn't want me giving some sugar to Bertha? Bonnie, 9 hours until I ship out, and you really want to waste time arguing about this? Well, tonight we had 13 hours, and you wasted it dragging Bonnie along. How did you even rope Rachel into going along with that one, huh? Steve, Bucky says, running his hands through his hair. I just want you to remember that you've got options, all right? I don't want options. Well, you got them, okay? And if I don't end up coming back, I want you... Steve won't let him finish. He knows what Bucky's gonna say anyhow. About how Steve might have a real shot at the wife and the kids and the whole deal. This is a fight they've been having for months, and he refuses to go through it again. Instead, Steve launches himself at Bucky, tackling him back onto their bed. He kisses him hard, hissing, "Shut the hell up," against Bucky's mouth. "And fuck me." Bucky does just what he's told. With 6 hours until Bucky ships out, and 10 before Steve is expected to get on a train to Camp Lehigh, they finally fall asleep.
With 3 hours until Bucky ships out, and 7 before Steve is expected to get on a train to Camp Lehigh, Steve wakes up with Bucky's nose just a couple inches from his. Despite his exhaustion, bone deep and aching, he doesn't close his eyes. He just watches Bucky sleep for a while, until the morning is light enough for him to get out his sketchbook. Sitting with his legs crossed and Bucky's too big shirt draped over his shoulders, Steve draws. He captures Bucky's face in sleep, his eyelashes long and soft, mouth open to crack, hair messy over his forehead. When that's done, he turns the page and starts another sketch. The light's a little different now. Their time ticks down and the sun gets higher. Steve's drawing getting progressively more frantic, his lines darker, less precise, scribbled. By the time Bucky's blinking open his eyes and groaning, 20 minutes before Steve is planning on waking him, Steve's drawings are downright abstract. Bucky wraps his hand around Steve's knee, and Steve bends down to kiss him, closing the sketchbook and hiding it under the pillow. They stay in bed until the last possible moment, and then Bucky rolls away, groaning as he gets to his feet. Steve relinquishes his shirt, and then pulls his knees to his chest, watching Bucky move around the room as he gets dressed. When he's once more all put together, so handsome and every bit the soldier, Bucky stands by the bed and just sort of shrugs. "Well," he says. Steve stands on his knees, shuffling closer and wrapping his arms tight around Bucky. "I love you a lot," he says, right into Bucky's neck. "I love you a lot." There's not much left to say beyond that. Steve dresses in his Sunday best and then locks the apartment door tight behind him. If all goes to plan, he won't be coming back here for a long while. He thought about going to fill Rachel in first, to tell her to live here until he's back. But if he actually does end up in the army by some miracle, then Aletta will do fine. She's already got a key. Dr. Erskine is waiting for him on the platform, like they discussed the night before, the train to take them up to New Jersey behind him. He waves as Steve approaches and hands over a ticket. "Are you ready for this, Mr. Rogers?" he asks, smiling a little. Steve takes a deep breath and fights off a cough. "I'm ready,"